Hey, welcome everybody. I'm going to just say okay to this being recorded. I'll invite you all to do the same. Good to see some familiar faces and some faces back from days gone by. very exciting. I'm also very excited to welcome Arnold Levin and Bonnie Tolan today to talk with you about bias, hidden bias in design. I'm going to take a moment to introduce these two and then turn it over to them. First, there's Arnold Levin. Arnold has presented at a conference in the past. It was one of our first virtual conferences, I think. Is that right?
Yeah,
Yeah.
it was right at the height of the pandemic.
It was indeed. It was quite an experience, and we were all just learning that. But we welcome him back to spend some time with us. Arnold has 40-plus years of experience in design strategy and org design. He's done work in feasibility planning, a lot workplace design, research into design. He's got clients globally. A broad range of clients, the government, the GSA, Blue Cross Blue Shield, Caterpillar, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, to mention a few. His academics include an MBA in design management and a master's of philosophy in org design. So truly well-schooled in the field. He's well-published as well with articles in the Journals of Facility Management, the Journal of Design Management. He's an all-around scholar, practitioner, and we're delighted to have him in the community. Joining us today is Bonnie Toland, who also works for Gensler. Both of these fine folks are on the staff at Gensler, which is, I guess, it's a design firm, right? It's a working in commercial space, designing of commercial space. Is that right, Arnold?
Right. Gensler is the largest architectural firm in the world. I'm not sure if that's something to be proud of or not, but
There you go.
Bonnie and I are part of the strategy practice.
Right, okay, there you go. And Bonnie has got a back has got a bachelor's in cultural studies and political science, but also another degree in interior design. She's worked nationally, she's worked internationally, speaks four different languages, and it's not just worked in design, but has led workshops in anti-racism, folkloric dance, which I think is fascinating, as well as among her languages is Italian, and she has taught Italian. So I want to welcome you both, Bonnie, Arnold. We're looking forward to a really interesting session. I'll let you guys take it away and I'll hang around and watch for raised hands and information in the chat.
Super. Well, we're really excited to be here. I participated in a number of these things with ODF, and so I'm really excited that Carlos invited us to make this presentation. So some background on where this sort of derived from and how we got here. This was originally a presentation that Bonnie had researched and put together, focusing on unconscious design bias, in the world of space and how it impacts, a designer's perception of working with clients and, making that transition in terms of, the undercurrents, so to speak, of whatever unconscious, bias a designer brings into when looking at space solutions. My role at Gensler and one of my, passions, has been to, connect workplace design strategy to organizational design. Because I've always believed, that most of the problems that we're dealing with our clients, in the realm of workplace, are really organizational problems. They're not space problems. The space solutions are a tool. And so my role and my work at Gensler has mostly been working with clients, in focusing on what kinds of organizational design changes does a client need to make in order to fulfill their aspirations and goals for the project at hand. And so in talking to Bonnie, I felt that there was a strong assimilation and translation between what she had originally presented and the types of ways that we look at designing organizations and the type of unconscious design bias that we potentially bring in as practitioners to that world. And we felt that it was worth sort of a provocation to discuss with everybody here and share. So we're excited to be here.
Right. So the lens through which we understand our world, which each of us has, defines how we work together and within organizations. When we had the original presentation had how we understand and move through space, but it also has to do with how we work with each other. And the way that we design our organization, it then reinforces how our worldview. So these, it's sort of the idea too, that when you build a space, first you build the space and then the space builds you, sort of the same idea here as well.
So one of the things that we felt, you know, for the presentation would be useful, you know, was to look at it through, you know, the lens of how, as organizational designers, we work with our clients. And we felt that obviously, you know, the STAR model was, you know, the you know, probably the easiest framework to start it. We could have looked at a number of different, you know, analytical frameworks to use, but we felt because of, you know, how often, you know, this model is used in various, configurations, that would be a good lens to look at the topic that we wanted to discuss in terms of, you know, how, you know, unconscious bias, you know, really impacts our view of the type of analysis that we bring to a client, you know, when we're designing their organizations, we're doing a redesign of their organization.
So these are some biases. I guess there are many, many ways to understand bias. There are many different biases beyond these. As we said, this was originally intended to look at space. So these first six were first looking at them as they related to space. And there were another two around senses and around proxemics, proxemics meaning how we space ourselves. But because those are so linked to the physical world, we took those two out and we added agency and control and managing meaning. So I'm going to move on to looking at each of these and the field dependence. We'll start with this image. So there was an anthropologist out of the University of Michigan. Perhaps you know him, Edward T. Hall. He did a study where he showed an image not dissimilar from this one to students at the University of Michigan and students at the university in Beijing. And then he asked them, he showed it for maybe, I can't remember, 45 seconds, something like this. And then he asked them to describe it. And what was interesting about the descriptions was that the students at the University of Michigan were very good at describing these main characters. So they could tell you, oh, it was an angelfish, it was yellow and black, and they could give you a lot of details about the main characters. But they were not as good at describing the context around the fish. And the students at the University of Beijing were not as good at describing all the details of the main characters, but they were much better at describing the context around the fish. And so this idea of field dependence is really how we contextualize ourselves and how we contextualize objects and things and ideas even. So another example that he gave was how we were looking at news coverage. There was a shooting, I think it was in Wisconsin, a man had shot his boss, and the US coverage of the shooting said, deranged man shoots his boss. The same event was covered in Chinese media saying that man who lost his wife to cancer and was then fired shoots his boss. So the idea that your environment and all of the factors around you play out in how you show up in the world. This ability to contextualize, or in the US we call it here field dependence, but in the US we tend to be very field independent, thinking that things we as individuals and the things within our environment live independently from each other and are not affected. So I could take this sea turtle, I can put it in an aquarium, I can put it in a different setting, and it will behave the same, which is probably not the case. And you can see how this might affect our how we relate to the collective versus how we relate to ourselves individually, how we identify. Another example was a study they did with selfies. So they asked students in the US to take selfies. And when you think of a self, it was like 80% of the frame was the person. You know, it's me, it's myself. And they asked students in Japan to take selfies, and they tended to put themselves in the corner and really emphasize their environment and their surroundings. So again, this example of seeing yourself as part of something larger, or seeing yourself as your own agent. So we want to ask you, and Arnold, you can take it away, but we want to have a conversation and ask you, how might field dependence affect organization design?
I think here is where we're looking for people to contribute to hopefully the conversation, and use the chat box to be able to offer some thoughts on that. But again, going back to the STAR model, how might it affect incentives for rewards? So going back to the STAR model, if we use the reward system to be able to either change or influence behavior, it has the possibility of being impacted, by this type of bias in terms of what we bring to how we view it and how we view our client and how we view the central problem, so to speak. How does it affect, how we think about developing, structures, within our organizations, and management structures, if one goes back to the model that Henry Mintzberg did, where you've got a chain and a link, and a hub, making those decisions, we like to think of them as being made, in an unbiased way. We like to think about those decisions that we make for our clients, being made sort of through a neutral lens. But I think what we've come to see, is that often that so-called neutral lens is influenced and informed by our own environment in terms of how we were educated, how we grew up, and what our perception is of organizational context.
I see that we have a couple comments in the comment box, one from Jim Dowling, another from Dennis Hutchinson, and then Christine, you have your hand raised. Would you like to ask
Yes.
a question or make a comment?
Sure. Yeah, as I'm listening to this, I'm reflecting on working for a global company that is often able and willing to have people go on assignments internationally from where they started. It ends up being a leadership team at a particular location or in a particular function that is made up of people coming from different countries. And that shows up in this conversation, I think, with very different biases and preferences for policy setting, for what's important in leadership, and for even things like recruiting, incentives and reward, and how each leader holds those things to be, what's a successful demonstration of these. So I'm seeing how that impacts a company like where I work.
Thank you. Joel?
Yeah, Bonnie, I love the question. I think it positively are the frame you introduced. Maybe, well, let me start negative. Some nations are negative, but negatively, we're gonna, if we're designing organizations, especially in the West, we're gonna be more biased to the part. We're gonna try to optimize the part or think that that piece of the organization can operate perhaps more independently than it can in reality. So systems thinking, right? It's less about the relationship of the parts and we're optimizing the part. I think positively, I try to then put a positive spin. The focus on the object or the agency would maybe create more agency that you can shape the system so that you're taking a less maybe passive approach to context. So I think there's pros and cons, but
Absolutely.
as a Westerner who works with multinational company and it can mainly works in the US, I those negatives play out a lot in our org design work.
Yeah, move.
Bonnie, Arnold, anything you'd want to add to
No,
the
great. I mean, I think that, one of the objects of or the one of the goals of this presentation is to be able to acknowledge that we have these biases, that aren't necessarily deliberate, but they're informed by a number of these factors that we just went over, and how being much more aware of them, could impact how we work with our clients, particularly when we work with international clients. I mean, I've experienced that the difference when I do, assignments and projects here in the States, versus, work that I've done both in Europe and particularly in Asia. Thinking that I was looking at these things through a very neutral analytical lens, was really, sort of, clouding what the reality was. And I began to look at, how certain influences that I had, both in education and perception, was really, sort of, shading some of the analysis that I was doing. And I could have been a little bit more open, in terms of how I was approaching the client's problem.
This object fixation is really a cousin to the field dependence, and this is the idea that the objects are not only independent of their context, but they're static as well. And so this, you end up with this idea of FTEs and PTEs, and people become sort of components that you can fit and play into, and it plays out on people, on places, and things. And you think of museumization, so. Maybe the British Museum, the idea of taking an object out of its context and putting it in a box that becomes something to admire, but that also creates, it makes it static. It no longer can evolve its meaning and its purpose because it's not within its context. But you can see this in a spatial manifestation with designers such as Frank Lloyd Wright or Rem Koolhaas, who would bolt their furniture down. So that you couldn't move it. So then the space becomes more of a sculpture than it is a living organism. And so I wonder, how does this play out when you're looking at organizational design? And perhaps it has to do with thinking of people as static and as not changing. Maybe this has to do with the growth mindset, perhaps. But I want to, maybe we'll skip the, let that be in your minds, and then we'll keep moving on some of the biases because our time moves quickly, and the next slide is on time. And time is such a huge topic. We haven't been on clock time for very long. And we started this conversation today around time zones when we got on the call because we're in different time zones. Well, time zones didn't exist before trains. So they had to invent time zones to keep the train schedules synchronized. And before trains, we also didn't have even synchronized time within the same time zone. Every town would have a clock tower, and that clock tower would read a different time depending on what town you were in. But when you have a train system, you have to synchronize to be able to keep the schedule. So that was a huge moment in synchronizing our time. And you think of our clocks and what were the first clocks? They were sundials. Originally, we all were on sun time. And you see that in historic and literature as well. They wrote at dawn. Well, dawn was a time that everyone could agree on. We all know what time dawn is. But there are still places that really design, or I mean, think around sun time. You think of Islamic prayers that are at different angles of the sun, for example. And sometimes that comes into conflict when you're trying to homogenize or unify or synchronize everybody. I grew up in Southeast Alaska, and our days are very, very short in the winter. Our days are very, very long in the summer. And I spent the majority of my childhood indoors during daylight hours because that was the standard school system time to be, in class. But our depression rates are sky high. Our suicide rates are very high. And could it be a bit of a mismatch between how we're looking at time and our insistence on sort of this time hegemony? And you see that also happening when, like, for example, in the Mediterranean, lunch is the most important meal of the day. And traditionally, people take 2 hours, 3 hours to have lunch. They eat it with their families. They take a nap. They take a walk. You have this big break in the middle of the day. Well, that doesn't work with an international work model. So people are having to change the way that they do things in order to to fit into this model that isn't made for them. So you see that, and you feel bad for the Spaniards because on the one hand, they're not giving up their late night meal, you know, their dinners at 10 and 10 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night, but they've had to give up their siesta because of the international model. And so what's happening is they're just tired all the time. If you have Spanish friends, go ask them, are you tired? And they'll probably say, yes, we're tired. But this also goes to calendars. I mean, there are many different calendars in the world. The Gregorian calendar is not the only calendar. And if you are non-Christian in this country, you know what that feels like to not be seen in the calendar, because your holidays are not the holidays that are acknowledged in the calendar. There are three small villages in Alaska that recently won a battle to adjust their calendar, their school year, to accommodate subsistence hunting and fishing in the summer and in the spring and in the fall. Four generation students had to choose between them, and it was a difficult battle. But finally, now students don't have to choose anymore. You think of the UAE just switched their calendars from Friday, Saturday to Saturday, Sunday. Well, Emiratis are Muslim and their holy day is Friday, but that no longer aligns with their weekend. So people are often asked to make really difficult choices between their sense of time, their sense of the calendar of, and the sense that is being sort of the dominant sense. This also has to do with rhythm and speed. And so you think of, for example, the quintessential New Yorker as being the fast speaker. And you think of potentially the quintessential, I don't know, Alabaman as being maybe a slower speaker. And when we're talking about speed, speed usually wins, meaning that the speed is always considered somehow better. And so you're thought of, if you're faster, you're thought of as smarter, which of course is not the case. And I find that for myself, I need to take pause sometimes, because there's a tendency when you are a faster talker to fill those gaps, to fill all of those spaces. And so you're cutting out the opportunity for people who are not as fast speakers to even engage and participate to begin with. So a question to all of you, how might that show up when you're talking about organizational design?
I think just as a further example to sort of reinforce this, the time issue is becoming even more critical now, you know, with all the work that's being done around hybrid work, you know, where again, you know, we were, and again, you know, this translates very differently for a multinational organization, you know, in the States versus one that's in the Middle East or in Asia, in terms of both the perception of time and the value of time. And so, you know, the work that, you know, we've been doing around organizations adapting a hybrid work policy or strategy, you know, when we begin to look at the organizational, you know, design that either reinforces that or inhibits that, you know, one of the biggest issues is, you know, time, because again, as you know, most of us experienced at the early days of the pandemic, when we were working, you know, 100% virtually, you know, time almost stood still because we were, you know, working, you know, at hours that we normally didn't work, you know, in the pre-pandemic day. And now that we're designing for a hybrid work strategy where people have the ability to work at different times of the day and at different places, you know, the whole perception of time becomes either an inhibitor or a enabler of organizational success.
Some really interesting comments popping up in our chat. I'd invite Arnold and Bonnie to take a look, and it's getting quite rich now. We've got like five or six comments in there. I'd invite you to take a quick look and maybe offer a couple of comments. I'm fascinated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Starting with Jim Dowling's comment around, are you designing for a better future, or are you a better tomorrow, or how rooted are we in our legacy, our culture, looking backwards? Fascinating stuff.
I think the point for me is that it's a negotiation. It's a conversation that we need to have. We set aside assumptions about what is best, and be willing to have give people some agency in making some of those choices as a collective. That's me.
Right. I was looking at Stephanie's comment about, you know, how the client perceives, you know, forever and going mm-hmm. to, you know, versus going too slowly. You know, I think, you know, one of the, mm-hmm. you know, the challenges in working with organizations, you know, that I'm sure most everybody here has experienced, you know, is that, you know, both the exactitude of the solution that clients are expecting, but also the time frame, you know, within that, as opposed to looking at organizational design solutions as evolutionary. You know, that, you know, that, you know, unlike the algorithms that we all love to sort of fall back on because of how influenced we are by Google, you know, the whole role of or the whole perception of organizational design is that we're dealing with people, you know, and, you know, that influences, you know, how people adapt to change. And so the types of transformation programs that we work with our clients, you know, really has a much more fluid approach where the client is looking at it and much more, you know, I want the change tomorrow. And of course, they never make those decisions.
I can't help but think about agile. And I think when I have interactions with clients and that word comes into the conversation, first of all, I usually cringe, but it's so often about speed of response. Mm-hmm. It's about time, right? It's about how quickly can we adapt, how quickly can we change, and how quickly can we respond, react to what's coming at us from the client customer side.
That's a good point.
Great stuff.
Hey, can I ask a question? Stephanie, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I liked your comment on delay versus going fast. Can you just say what you mean by activation? That we delay in design, or it takes a long time, and then activation. Sorry. What do you mean by activation?
So that would be the implementation of the new design that they've selected.
When we hit that point, we find reasons to go slow.
Yeah, it was interesting. I appreciate, Bonnie, your elaboration, because my mind went right to the differing perceptions of what is fast and what is slow, and, you know, what is iterative and what is done. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I have my own bias that was what was happening. But yeah, we get the hurry up, hurry up. Now we're going to ruminate and slide back and maybe doubt. And so, you know, what was slow has become too fast. And it's really just an interesting dynamic with most clients.
I had a client in the UAE. It was a philanthropic organization. And as a workplace designer, which is what I did before coming into strategy, efficiency is always such a huge priority for everybody. Everyone wants really efficient spaces. They want people to be really productive and efficient. And this client, he looked at me and said, "Well, what if efficiency is not our main goal?" And it just blew my mind. What do you mean efficiency isn't that is the goal, isn't it? But that was my bias. I had been conditioned to think that was the ultimate goal. Anyway. So the next bias we're looking at is ritual and hospitality. This is how you host and how you guest, or how you are hosted, because there are norms to both. And those norms obviously are not universal. And speaking of the UAE, we were, as an architecture firm, we were looking to partner with a local firm, which is actually an Iranian firm, regional firm. And we went into their office, but instead of them taking us into a meeting room, they took us into what's called a majlis. A majlis is like a living room. So you go into the space and it's these sofas, nice cushy sofas. The lighting is warm and more of hospitality or even residential in feel. And there are little tables around, because they will serve you something. They will serve you tea or coffee or sweets or chocolate or something, juice. They will serve you something, because to not serve you something would be unimaginable. That's just part of the norm of what it means to host. And of course, to guests, there are practices that you need to adhere to as well as a guest. And you'll find, I think, that most people have some type of norms around hospitality, and how does that play out in a physical space or in a physical environment? Is like, do you have a receptionist? Do you have a place for people to sit when they come in? Do you have someone greet them and bring them somewhere else? Do you bring them something like a offer, some kind of an offering, or are they expected to get it themselves? And how is that baked into how work is done and how that day progresses? And rituals can be, you know, we've had this conversation where it can be a collective ritual or an individual ritual or practice, but how does that organization or that physical environment support those rituals, or does it, or doesn't it support them? And what happens when the two come at odds with each other? Another part is the greetings and farewells, and you know, living in the Arab world for quite a long time, one of the things I loved was how if I come into a group of people, I have to go and greet everybody in that circle, whether I know them or not. But if I'm Arnold's friend and I'm with all of Arnold's friends, they are now my friends and I must greet them all. So there is a sense of arrival and acknowledgement of me, and then acknowledgement of them. And the same is true on my departure. So when I leave, I go and I say goodbye to everybody in that circle as well. And there are times when I came back to the US, it was like a bit of a culture shock to remember that there are times when you come into a space, you don't greet anybody and nobody greets you, and you leave and nobody says goodbye, you just go. And so for me, there was like, where's that sense of arrival and where's that sense of departure? But the point of it is that the way that we do these things are not universal, and yet they are often baked into how we consider space or how we consider how the organization functions or doesn't function. And to think about what rituals we want to acknowledge and to pull forward and to encourage. So a bit of an invitation to how have you seen this show up in your practice, in your work? And I can't see the chat, so if someone is saying something, please let me know.
I'm watching the chat. Yeah, and we have Jim Dowling has made a comment. Jim, I'm not sure how it relates to the welcoming part. Maybe you want to explain that, you can clarify, or maybe it was not directly related.
It doesn't.
Okay.
I was just in the process of typing, but in my experience, when I arrive in the office in Paris, I visit every office and I say good morning and ask them how the commute was, and we all laugh because it's always horrible. And then we get on our business, and at the end of the day, we regroup and we typically have a glass of wine or a beer, and everybody is ushered off to home for dinner. Different practice in Denmark, different practice in Germany, different practice in Italy, different practice in Japan. But the key is don't violate a ritual. Mm-hmm. So we actually took a course taught by Price Waterhouse and Company at the U.S. Embassy on assimilation. And it was unbelievably effective at helping to understand the rituals that you could violate as you walked in into a new office in a new country where you were going to be operating.
And the question too is, so what do you do when you have a diverse office, how do we build some kind of consensus around the rituals that we want? And I mean, I feel like there is often going to be a dominant culture, a dominant voice, and how do we make sure there's space for voices that are not the dominant voice and give room? I had a boss, a very forward-thinking boss in Wisconsin, and he would always do, he had this big table and he would always have these sort of beer drinking things, which was perfect for this guy from Wisconsin. But when he ended up with employees who were from different parts of the world, it didn't always translate into that it didn't have that same communal feeling. Maybe they didn't drink beer or they didn't want, you know, whatever it was. It was sort of this misalignment. And that's where that bias comes in too, because you're thinking these people are great. They fit right in with my rituals, and we can chum around and, you know, go to the same church and have the beers together. And like, we feel this is wonderful. But then when you have someone come in who doesn't fit in with that ritual, how do we make sure that they still feel welcome too? And that there are maybe new rituals that include them, you know, I think that's a challenge that a lot of us in a multi-ethnic, multicultural, multi, you know, very diverse society grapple with.
I mean, I've coached both sides of that conversation, and make it an explicit conversation. Mm-hmm. What is it about working where you were that made you uncomfortable and you wouldn't want to see here? Just that frank conversation that everybody has different cultural backgrounds and rituals that they adhere to, and just make them known to everybody. Don't sit in your corner and feel bad because you're being pressured for an answer now, when you're supposed to be answering the questions at dinner after work hours, because that's the tradition. That's the ritual in the culture. Don't push for answers now, but it has to be both sides of that have to be involved in that conversation. Frankly, tell me what annoys you, and frankly, we will call us if we don't if we do.
Hmm.
And it works.
Well, it's interesting because I think that brings us to this next one, which is about privacy and respect and a bit of code switching too. We have a very, in the US, a very sort of a model of respect that tends to be about sameness. So, you know, I'll be, hey, Arnold, hey, James, hey, Carlos, you know, we're all on the same level, and I show respect to you by showing that we're the same. But that isn't always universal either. You've got this concept of deference as a show of respect as well. So I'm going to say, thank you, Mr. Dowling. I appreciate your comment. And Mr. Levin, I am so glad that you're here today. You know, there's a certain level of deference that I'm going to put you above me to show that I respect you. And so that can cause some mismatch as well. And that maybe in the situation that you're saying, does that even come at odds with, is it my place to say what makes me uncomfortable, or do I just need to deal with it, you know? But also these delineations of privacy and those boundaries. I think, like, as a white American myself, first of all, we don't invite each other to our homes that much. It's not the huge part of our culture, which is not universal. But when we do invite people to our homes, we tend to give people tours of our homes. Right? So having, you know, living in the Arab world for a long time, inviting to each other's homes is a huge part of the culture, but there is a place in the house that is dedicated to hosting, and do not wander out of that. That would be a faux pas. You're going into people's private space. That's not what you do. But that also translates into a work environment where you have, like, there are some places where you have that formal area for visitors, and then you don't want your visitors going back into seeing how the sausage is made or where the sausage is made even. But whereas in the US, we tend to be like, we like to see how things are put together. We like to see, you know, behind the screens. We want to see what's happening. So it's understanding sort of those differences as well. And I want to say most of this is international, but it's also national. We see these kinds of things play out in different ways regionally. We see it playing out with different groups demographically as well. So I think of a dominant culture, but we have a lot of what would you call it, subcultures too. And they can all come into odds with each other. But you can see how this would play out in how we design a space, how we design an office. But the question is, how does this play out in how we design an organization?
I think here, the whole impact, I mean, the whole discussion around, private space is something that's, predominated the world of workplace over, a decade at least, where people, are assigned, spaces in the open versus private offices based on title and status, as opposed to, need, and effectiveness, and but also it's influenced. And I think as organizational designers, as well as workplace designers, we tend to ignore the sort of hidden perception about, privacy as a cultural prerogative or imperative. And we look at it purely, in black and white terms. Either you need privacy to focus because you're an introvert, or you don't need privacy to focus because you're an extrovert, as opposed to, people's perception of the need for privacy at various times of the day.
Let's see, nothing popped up in the chat just yet. I will say I've worked, I think I've worked in two very different organizations that both had typical hierarchies, but one had a hierarchy that was permeable. In other words, the cultural part of it was I was allowed to talk to the people above me. In fact, I was expected to, and to be friendly with bosses. That was at Mars Incorporated. Then at IBM, it was like, hey, if you're a director and you want to talk to the VP, unless you're the direct report, you don't. Crossing that vertical boundary was always a little tricky, because people expected a certain level of organizational separateness, that you had to learn to honor. So it's probably more about culture than it is about org design, but the Mars structure was much flatter. And I think that suggested we don't want these levels to be too important, whereas IBM had way more levels in this organization. Status was more important and it was built in, and it was about that status really more than anything else. James, I see your hand is up. Jim Dowling.
I just to share a case. I ran into a situation where a client was converting from office spaces to open plan, and they dropped the partition height down to 40 inches. So you could actually see the tops of people's heads from everywhere, at least the tops of their heads. Well, we had three people who were autistic, and they got absolutely nothing done when everybody was looking at them, and there was every distraction on the planet was coming at them. So the client would not change the plan. And it turned out that it was the architect, who happened to be a relative of an owner of the company, who said, "No, don't change the plan. The people will learn to work in it." And that's, I think I lasted another 3 days on that project. And was asked to come back. But I just said, I don't think I can come back on Monday to work on this project if that's the way you're going to treat people." And lo and behold, a fellow walked in who was 7 feet two. And it was started all over again. His knees hit the underside of the desktops, and it's to understand that some people need the privacy beyond just wanting it, and that it's valuable to you to offer it is quite important. Probably another one was I ran into a situation where at Chrysler Motors, two people were absent from our workshops because they were given a 1 week no pay leave of absence for traveling to Germany on their own to learn how to put convertible tops on automobiles. They didn't go through the protocols of asking the boss to ask the boss to ask the boss to make the connection with the boss, et cetera, et cetera. And it's you're there trying to help these people be more effective and efficient, and they're just stepping on themselves.
And those are not easy conversations to have.
Mean, I think the point that you made about, particularly, neurodiversity, I mean, when I look back at my younger years, When I was, working with clients and developing, workplace design solutions, I was one of those designers, unfortunately, that had the bias that, if you put everybody, in low positions, they're going to be more collaborative. And if, and if a client said, I can't work that way, they were basically, coming up with excuses that they, why they didn't want to adapt as opposed to, did they really need to, and I eventually did this presentation called What I Learned About Workplace Strategy from My Daughter. And it was based on the fact that my daughter, is dyslexic and has ADHD. And what I began to look at was that if she ever worked in an office that I was responsible for designing, she wouldn't be able to function, because, growing up at school, because of the accommodations that she was afforded, she was able to go into a private room to take a test. She was able to, not sit in the middle of a classroom and take notes and have, teachers take the notes for her, and it definitely pointed out the biases that I had, in terms of these ideas and notions that we come up with, that, collaboration happens when everybody is, in a 40-inch high partition as opposed to a 72-inch high partition. And I think, it taught me a lot about, looking at my own biases that I brought to a client when I did the analysis, and the reasoning that I, would use to justify certain decisions. But, having a daughter go through that and that challenge that you saw with those three employees, is a very real, factor when we talk to organizations about how they really need to work.
So this bias is around order. And obviously this is a physical manifestation of order. So you have Paris, Marrakesh, Mexico City, Tokyo, Athens, and Toledo, Spain. And you can see the sort of the French wheel and spoke organization with very broad boulevards, clear sight lines. And some of that is military, military influenced around control. But as we know, when the French went into North Africa and they saw the Medina, they said, oh, this is chaos. Let me fix it. And so they came in and they started building their broad boulevards with their clear sight lines. And without understanding the incredible organic order that existed. So in the Medina, you have these small little streets here. And usually at the end of the street, you have the largest home, which is usually the most influential family. And that family often manages things like conflict resolution on the street, manages things like trash collection, kind of manages the street. And when you walk down that little street on the ground level, there aren't any windows looking in. That goes back to the privacy question, because you don't want people looking into your home. But on the second level, they have windows, but they're staggered. So you still don't look into each other's home. Neighbors don't look into each other's homes. And as you can see, all of these squares, it's a courtyard structure. So the homes are inward looking rather than outward looking. So you go in and you have this outdoor open space in the middle of the home. But the French didn't take the time to understand it. They didn't care. Or intentionally wanted to civilize them. This is the reality of it, and would put they would limit they would place, basically build around the old cities so that they couldn't grow, and they would put in their own structures of order. And so this is of course a physical manifestation, and you can see this coming into smaller spaces, interior spaces. You can see this also influencing how we understand organizational design and understand management and how things should work or shouldn't work. So how I'm curious if I see this from an architectural, from a design perspective, as being something that is alive and well today. When we go in and we design office buildings in all around the world to look like the office buildings in Chicago, we are basically doing what the French did in North Africa. We are taking our model of what it looks like to work, and we're saying, this is what it should look like to work here too. Do you see this happening, I guess, within an organizational design framework or practice.
So, any hands up? I don't see any yet. Any comments in the chat? Not yet. I will say that to me, it's order is very much the business of design. In other words, when I create with clients, we create an organization in all its facets. We are, in fact, bringing some kind of order to it, aren't we? I mean, it's about order, but order can look like a lot of different things. So I'll turn it over to William Zybach, who's got his hand up, and then Jim Dowling.
Thank you, Carlos. And thank you, Bonnie. And so my perspective is it depends on the type of organization. If we think about a spectrum of organizations from hierarchy to participative, flexible or prototyping, and then to agile, I run into this in the hierarchical. Again, people are making decisions. And again, we see this on a global basis where multinationals make a decision based on their model, and then they that's what they proliferate. That's what they spend. However, the organizations that are more adaptive, and even multinationals that are that way, are more sensitive to coming in and saying, what is it that is the approach that makes sense in the local ecosystem? Again, that's emerging. It's not dominant. But ultimately, it's when the mindsets are more not about control and command, but about sense and respond. And so that, to me, that's where I see the difference, Bonnie.
And I think that, you know, relating to that, the, you know, the work that, you know, we're doing with organizations, again, you know, that when we analyze clients that have successfully, you know, sort of pivoted during the pandemic to working virtually, you know, organizationally, they had much more agile models than those clients that were much more rigid and hierarchical. They had much more of a difficult time in making those transitions. And taking that a couple of years later, you know, in working with our clients that are considering working in a hybrid fashion, you know, the work that I've been doing with them has been pointing out that their organizational model, you know, their structural model, you know, needs to be much more agile for that to be able to work. And the whole idea about control and about order, you know, becomes a real, you know, challenge for an organization that is considering hybrid work when order is the so-called order of the day.
Thank you. I saw that Shelley's hand was up. Is Shelley still with us? Or did she, there she, Shelley, do you want to speak? Jim, we've heard from you a couple of times. I thought Shelley, you might be a different, bring in your voice at this point.
I appreciate that. I think what I was going to highlight is really similar to what William, I think it was William, was just saying. In my perspective, organizations I've been a part of, it's a lot of the standardized operation, you know, create the standard operational efficiency where you can look at the organization and know that things like performance management in the sales organization, it's very different. Their needs are different. The expectations are different. But when we come in with this need to create a consistent practice and process, regardless of what's in the best interest of the people in the locations, I think that's that bias coming into play. And I've seen where we try to roll out new ways of working and agile methodologies without regard for what's actually in the best interest of the people. It just creates friction and it breaks down the entire process we're trying to move forward with. So I've seen this, it's very frustrating. It's such a mindset shift. And I think when I think about agile, I don't think fast, I think adaptive. Mm-hmm. So if you're gonna be agile, be adaptive and think about why are we doing the things that we're doing. And our role as org designers is to be the one to have those courageous conversations to get to why are you doing this. At the end of the day, is it cost effectiveness? Is it efficiency? Is it engagement? So that was what I wanted to share.
Thanks. Thank you, Shelley. Jim, I noticed you took your hand down. We have a couple of minutes left here. We are coming up to the top of the hour. Unless you're in Newfoundland or India, in which case it's altogether different. But Jim, did you want to get one last comment in before we move on?
Ariane posted a question here about curiosity about how this plays out in all remote orgs. Two examples. One was we took a all-in-one office space downtown Boston software development group, and we distributed it across the world. so that we had, so work started in Hawaii. It moved to California. It was handed off to Boston. It was handed off to Dubai. It was handed off to Malaysia, and then back to Hawaii. So you could deliver requirements, pick up requirements along the way and have them actually delivered, tested, and installed before you got back to work the next day. And the idea was self-organizing teams. You just figure, you let the teams figure out who they need from around the world to get the job done and assemble them into a team. Right. Some of them are in Boston and they're working on the Hawaii shift because that's what the need was and that's what they preferred to do. Did this very similar thing with a retailer that does a almost a complete inventory turnover three times a year. And they use volunteers at the peak selling seasons. We designed that so that even the leadership structure was remote. So it wasn't just the remote workers doing things and all the leaders centralized. The trick was to put the structure in the background as a backbone for self-organizing teams in both cases. And not self-organizing teams that they make up their own work. They're directed, but they figure out who in the organization from wherever they need them, what competencies do they need to get the job done, and then they go after it. And it, to the best of my knowledge, both of them are still operating 6-7 years later.
Thanks. Let me turn it back to Bonnie and Arnold. We have just a couple of minutes left. How do you want to bring this home?
I think, Bonnie, if you could just go over the next two slides quickly, and then we could just sort of wrap it up and any questions.
Yeah, these are all yours.
So I'll quickly go over this. I mean, the whole idea, about agency and control, becomes again a perception of, culturally. Which organizations, and it's almost like the recent example that you just gave of self-organizing teams, where people have control over their daily lives as opposed to being, told what to do during the course of their day. And so the whole role of agency and an individual's ability to control their work life, is of increasingly, critical conversation. And then the last point that we wanted to sort of make, was about, how we use organizational design to often manage meaning, and a lot of the transformation programs that I've been involved in, a client wants to brand the change. And often that branding of the change is really controlling the meaning of the change as opposed to really going through the benefit of the change. And, we almost act like advertising agencies sometimes with transformation programs as opposed to, looking at it from a much more holistic perspective.
Yeah.
So that's my New Year.
The way we design organizations reinforces our worldview. And to end it, these were the tips we give for designers. Context matters. Do your homework. Humility. Know that your lens is not the lens, that there are many lenses, many ways to do the same, to accomplish the same goals, and having an inclusive process so that everyone who will be affected has a voice.
Excellent. Arnold, thanks. Bonnie, thank you so much. We're getting a lot of thumbs up in the chat over here. We're lost in people, but thank you so much. It's tremendous, tremendous stuff. And I think there's way more here to explore and think about. So thank you for starting a great conversation and just being here for us.
Thanks for having us.
Jalma, did you want to ask something early before we?
Jalma, you're muted.
No, I just wanted to say that I think this is from a big picture lens and looking at all of this, do you guys use this as your outline for what you question in your initial consultation?
I'll be really frank with you, Jalma, this is our personal research.
Okay.
We're getting it is gaining traction. We've presented it quite a bit internally, and the more we do it, the more people want. So
This is a big, this is, to me, it looks very universal for providing clients with information if they hadn't thought about, important to think about, and for you getting information as to where the gaps are and what is actually going on here. You can get information very quickly in this way. And I find it profound.
Thank you.
All right. We will want to wrap up. Tanya, I think you usually get the final moments here, don't you?
Well, just because you always turn it back to me, but no need to.
Oh, nothing you need to say. Nothing you need to say about. Okay.
I want to thank Arnold and Bonnie for bringing this, your time and energy, bringing this to our community. We very much appreciate it. I will keep the line open for a few minutes. I don't have to jump off or anything now. If any folks have questions of me, or if Arnold and Bonnie have a few extra minutes to be able to stay online and engage. Otherwise, have a great rest of your day, and we will see you in the coming weeks with other upcoming sessions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for participating. And Tanya, thank you for your usual great organization.
Happy to make it happen. I just am so impressed with all you volunteers giving your time, energy, and genius to support this community. I love it.
Thank you, Tanya. And I do have a comment for Bonnie and Arnold. To me, what you've done